Welcome to the China Flexpat Podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Patrick. It's an honor to be here. Looking forward to the next 20 minutes of being able to talk with you about what it means to be an expat or a flexpat in China. My name is Peter Willemsen. I have done a bit of a journey through the East in the last 15 years. I have had the opportunity to live and work in Thailand for several months, in Japan for more than 2 years during university, and also working in Korea. I had a chance to work professionally for 2 years, and most of the time I've been now in China in total for over 12 years. And I'm from Germany originally, from the Cologne area. I've studied in Berlin, industrial engineering and management. And today I would like to discuss a little bit about this experiences of the journey, specifically in the automotive industry, specifically in the development or build-up of development centers in the automotive industry. I had various stations from engineering, program management, regional management, a lot of topics for strategic development in China. And I think throughout this time, I get a pretty good understanding of the requirements of working as a foreigner in China and also in other countries. And yeah, looking forward to share some of those with you today.
Peter, welcome to the China Flexpat Podcast. Today, it's especially exciting to have you here on the show because you are one of the first guests of our brand new leadership series where we don't ask the usual questions. So this episode is for expats and flexpats that are basically thrown into leadership positions. And I hope to get a lot of answers from you today about know-how transfer, R&D in China, and of course, leadership. We heard this a lot, but why is it required to localize research and development in China?
Well, it obviously depends, as usual, on the market and the product. In general, I think whenever you have the need for a strong local customer interface, having a local R&D setup is absolutely needed. You need to know your market, you need to know your customers. Also, the expectations from Chinese customers, at least that I know in the automotive industry, are relatively high compared to other regions with regards to the reaction speed, the level of service that they expect when they interact with you. Therefore, it's extremely important to be close to them and also to listen to them very closely. And last but not least, of course, localizing in China offers you some opportunities for a cost reduction, not only due to the reduction of the local engineering service and the cost of local engineering services, but also you need the local team in order to be able to interact with the local supplier base, which often has a different cost structure than international suppliers, and also to maybe lead better the negotiations with the customer. Increasingly, it's also important in China specifically to have the boots on the ground, because there's such a tremendous speed in local development in China that while in the past it used to be basically come to China, sell existing products that are developed maybe elsewhere for global companies, now very often you have in China is at the pinnacle of the development, at the forefront, and you need to have the development team here in order to participate in the latest trends.
You've been, as you mentioned, you've been working in different countries and different companies and in different functions. From your experience, when you can compare especially Germany and China, what is the main difference between R&D in those two countries?
Yeah, I already mentioned kind of working speed and reaction speed to customer requests. I mean, if a customer here calls you on a Friday evening at 7 o'clock and says, I want to have an answer, then it's not uncommon to say, okay, wait, and you'll have it Sunday morning. In other countries, then you might get an answer, I don't know, 1 or 2 weeks later. So let's say this kind of service level is really important. The other difference that I see is maybe the depth of the development and of the answer that you may get. So I would say specifically German engineers are extremely good at giving a very, very detailed, clear, well-evaluated, technical, perfect answer. Whereas in China, and for that matter, I can even speak for almost all of Asia, it might be more important to give a first answer quick. That is kind of like an 80-20 principle, because very often the question wasn't actually so detailed, or maybe the person asking the question doesn't really know what they want to know. So it's not really worthwhile spending all the effort on giving it right exactly the first time. And it's rather a process. In Korea, I made that experience. We had our customer Hyundai, and Hyundai in Korea is, of course, God, because that's the only customer in the automotive world. So I prepared a lot of details and presentations and spent a lot of effort. And then my colleagues were saying, hey, why are you doing this? This is like the first round presentation, right? Just take it easy. Just, you know, do the basics. And then anyway, they will say it's bad and you have to come back two times. No matter how much effort you put in the first time, you anyway have to come back two times. So learning out of this, especially in the first approach, sometimes 80-20 principle is, I think, really important. The other aspect, talking about engineering setup in R&D in China versus Germany, that is important to consider when you build up the team, is you will not have the absolute experts working for you for 10, 15, 20 years. This is very unusual in China. The average time that an employee spends in the company is maybe only 3 to 4 years. That means you have to get used, or you have to be aware that there will be a certain rotation or a certain fluctuation in the workforce. So you have to consider that from the beginning, you have a very strong onboarding and training process in place, and that you always think of maybe having two people working in a related field. So in case one is changing, you can exchange it or you can recover it. And yet you break down the tasks and not have one expert very, 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 very deeply involved, but rather distributed onto several shoulders, so that you are not so dependent on that one expert who is leading the entire team.
You are talking about rotation here, and I assume that leads to a lot of fear, especially in the management, and I can relate to that from my work as well. How much do you teach? How much knowledge do you give away, if you can say so? Is this the biggest fear involved for German automotive companies?
I would imagine so. I mean, at least when you talk about a technology company, obviously. So I think we have a certain knack for being good at engineering, being good at technology. This is one of our trademarks, which then translates into good processes, into good quality. But a lot of that is obviously in the heads of the people. And transferring that knowledge to China, building up a local team, means you might lose it. I personally don't see the risk so high that you lose it to a competitor directly, because that's rather rare that somebody really goes and copies one-to-one the know-how to a direct competitor. But what you do lose is the effort, the time, and the cost that you spend in training of the people. So coming back to my previous point, you need to somehow leverage that and need to make sure that you have a multi-head, so to say, strategy where you bring the knowledge to not just one person, but maybe two or three, and distribute it in case one of them decides to leave.
What would you do, or what can people do, managers, to avoid these kind of threats or risks, or at least soften the impact a little bit?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that you need to be aware of. China has had a reputation in the past of not being very good at IPR protection, so intellectual property protection. And while that is changing, and clearly the issue is addressed, also within the Chinese government, this is taking some time. So you don't want to leave your top secret information just lying around. You don't necessarily want to have everybody access to your evaluated bill of material prices or your the secret sauce of your products. How can you do that? Be prudent, I would say. Use reasonable caution. Have your hard drives encrypted. Block the USB ports. Maybe monitor the email flow, have a proper IT structure, IT system set up. make sure that you have in your employment handbook clearly written what is allowed and what is not allowed. Have the people sign NDAs and have them sign labor contracts that somehow levy a penalty if information is leaked out. I think these are all not very difficult things to do, but you have to know them. And especially when you come first time to China, it's probably a good idea to have somebody advise you on what is the standard for this one. Also, you don't have to transfer everything to China. I mean, it's totally fine if you say there's a part of your product, the secret recipe or the piece of code that is truly ingenious that you don't want to bring out over, then don't. Then keep that part in Europe or in Germany or in some other place where you feel it's more secure, and only bring over the part that is relevant for the application in front of the customer. In my experience, for many, many products, that is possible to do it. Finally, you can also say for these specific parts that you have that are connected to a deep know-how, and if you come to the conclusion that you need to have that deep know-how here in China, this could be an opportunity to bring an expat over as a counterpart to the flexpat, and say, okay, that person can do everything, he knows everything, and I trust him because he's only here for 2 or 3 years and he knows he wants to go back, so he's not going to share any state secrets. So in sum, have a clear plan and be prudent, and then the risk can be minimized.
When you decide how much of your technology you want to transfer or how much of the development you want to place in China, are there any, let's say, government requirements? So let's say the government requires a certain level of know-how transfer in exchange for a business license or in exchange for a setup of a new production plant.
Not to my knowledge. There is, of course, certain requirements with regards to the registered capital. For sure, the government will encourage you to bring more engineering know-how over. Very difficult for them to measure real know-how. So instead, what they do is to look into things like tax subsidies. So most famously, it's the super deduction and the high new technology enterprise tax reduction, where you go from a 25% corporate tax to 15% if you meet certain criteria. These criteria include that you need to have a number of patents registered. I don't know, I think 10 or 15 that are somehow related to your products, but somehow, as it turns out, is a relatively flexible term. And the other requirement is that you spend 3% of your turnover for engineering services or for engineering personnel. Again, that can also include a number of activities in process engineering or quality engineering. So it's a quite broad term, but this is kind of the only real criteria that I'm aware of that then qualify to have a preferential tax treatment. Other than that, it's relatively easy to set up a company. There is not any barriers to jump over.
Well, that's interesting. So there are some financial benefits of transferring know-how. I think there are still many companies out there who so far just have had sales offices or production plants in China, but it looks like more and more people are setting up also R&D centers. So you have experience with that. Can you guide us a little bit about how the process looks like of setting up an R&D center in China?
I had the joy of doing this journey several times. I think the most noteworthy one was when I started working in Nanjing in 2011 and set up there a new tech center for HELLA. At the time, we really started from zero. Yeah, I was literally myself in a hotel room. And by the time I left 3 years later, we had more than 100 engineers sitting in that location. And I think it's basically three phases, because three is always a good number. The starting phase, where you just have to do the basics. You have to get a room, get a place, register a company, interact with the local authorities, find what can be suitable places to access people, maybe talk to a recruitment company in the beginning, contact universities, etc. So do the basics. And this probably takes 6 months to a year. And then you are somehow running and maybe have your first dozen or half dozen people on board. And then comes the aggressive growth area. So then you basically have all your tools, all your basic functions fulfilled, and then you really start hiring and training. So in this case, usually you don't do much else. You have every day maybe 5 interviews, and then you try to pick the best people out of this one. And then once the people start coming on board, you need to go with them through a rigorous training program. So you make classes. Coming from the automotive industry, you have to basically talk about what does automotive industry mean for your company, go through the processes, make the contacts with the headquarters, etc. So this is, I would say, the growth phase. And then maybe after a year and a half, you have then your team has grown to maybe 30 to 50 people, or at least in my case, it had, depending on the company and the setup that you have, might be different. And then you go more into the continuous improvement. So then you have people on board. Then maybe you go really into the details of the product know-how. You start to grow your business. So you go out, acquire a new business, do lots of application engineering projects. Then the first problems happen. Then the first people quit and you have to replace them. More and more you go into a, I would say, normal improvement mode. And that basically lasts then from anywhere to however many years you want to stay there, where you are in this kind of continuous improvement mode and you have to continuously work on that. So roughly that is, I think, the three phases. I think what's very important is you need to have from the beginning a clear plan what you want to achieve. Yeah, so you have to know your customer, your market, have to have done the research before. You need to have a very, very good alignment with the people in the headquarter, what they really want to do. If you go there and then later on find out that actually nobody wants to build up engineering resources, it's going to be very, very tough, because then it's an uphill battle. And you need to have this kind of top level commitment, and that usually has to come all the way from the top with regards to what you want to set up there. And lastly, as I said before, looking into subsidy possibilities, work close with the local government. I would always recommend to also reach out to local universities. I've made very good experiences that just yesterday we had with Chiao Tung University, a great event. So this is definitely something that can give you access to good people, but also really a quick way of building up know-how. So I think that's the most important aspect.
You mentioned in a very short time, you have hired 100 engineers. I can only imagine how tough that must have been. Can you remember how many people did you interview to get 100 engineers?
No, I don't remember, honestly, because at some point I also didn't do all the interviews myself. But in my experience, you have the rough logic. I think the metric we always said, if you want to hire one person, you need to have at least 10 resumes. Out of the 10 resumes, you maybe then invite 5 people or 4 people. You then find maybe 2 people suitable and make them an offer. And finally, you get maybe 1 person who confirms. So at least from a resume to people on board, factor 1 to 10, if it's a difficult position to fill, maybe even more.
And in terms of quality of the people, when you set up a new R&D center, are you looking for hiring 100, let's say, top level engineers? Or are you also saying, okay, we can allow 30% of like engineering school graduates and we have the capacities to train them? Or are you saying, no, we only want the top level at the beginning because we don't have the time to train people? How do you do it?
I would say in the initial startup phase and maybe the beginning of the growth phase, probably you want to get experienced people. It simply doesn't make sense when you start from scratch to hire a bunch of university graduates, because then they might be super motivated and might have a great attitude, but you need somebody who can build up the team. Not saying that there should not be 1 or 2, but generally in the beginning, the more experienced people. But then absolutely, it's important to start filling the team with maybe 20, 30% of graduates, or at least relatively junior professionals. First of all, you need to start building the team from the bottom. So as the people need to be replaced, you need to allow these people to grow up over time. Secondly, it's important to keep somehow a cost structure in place. Otherwise, as the team matures, so do the costs. And then very quickly, this runs out of proportion. And then the advantage of the lower engineering costs in China are gone. And thirdly, yeah, it's, you want to, same as in a population, you kind of want to maintain a healthy population or a healthy age structure in a team. So you constantly have to refill, and you tend to refill usually rather from the bottom than from the top, especially then in the third stage where you are in this continuous improvement mode.
And also, I think you mentioned motivation, and I'm interested in how do you motivate an R&D team? I mean, a sales team is quite obvious. You have sales, you have incentives, and you have some personal goals as well, and of course, turnover related goals. How do you motivate a fresh R&D team?
I think when you talk about KPIs, so KPI settings in China are important because it's absolutely customary that even on a very junior level, you receive part of your salary as a bonus. So typically companies have, for example, 12-month salary plus 2 months bonus, even from a starting level. And these 2 months bonus, or sometimes one, sometimes three, usually are flexible, and you can link them to kind of expectations. So in other words, KPIs. And the way I do it always is there's some personal topics where the people have to maybe develop themselves. Then you have maybe some specific technical aspects. If you talk about engineering, could be reaching a certain project milestone, or could be finishing a certain task. But I always think it makes also sense to include some general targets in there that are linked to the overall success of the company. So in my experience, engineering is also always somehow involved in cost improvement topics, because they, through design to cost, they have a strong influence in that. They are also very often involved in acquisition topics, because ultimately in the engineering discussions with the customers, it's the engineers who later on develop the product who are also involved. So typically I also mix those in the mix of the KPIs. And I think if you have that, then you have a good motivation of the people, and they somehow see how that is linked to the company targets.
Now that we have learned about the process of setting up an R&D center, for example, or can you tell us, for what kind of company does it actually make sense to localize R&D? Because I can imagine it's not for everyone.
Yeah, as I said, I think important is there's somehow local customer contact needed. I mean, if you're selling an absolute commodity product, then you don't need necessarily local engineering. So there has to be something where you say this is special for China, or there's special requirements in China, or the product needs to be adapted. In my opinion, you don't always have to have the complete development here. So if you say local customer contact is important, then imagine a development cycle to be like a V. So we call it a V cycle. And the top left corner is basically the customer requirements. And then you go through all the development steps and testing steps at the pinnacle of the V. And then you go up again through the validation. And finally, the validation at the customer on the right-hand side of the V. So depending on the flavor that you prefer, you then have maybe only the top left and right corner, or you go further down, or you pick specific items down the development level, for example, software development, or maybe hardware development, or mechanical design, because there's opportunities to interact with local supplier bases. So you really need to think at the specific aspect of your development cycle where you can contribute something more. China is not a low-cost country anymore. This was maybe the storyline 10 years ago. This has changed dramatically. For a well-experienced engineer in the tier one or tier two cities, so somehow in the eastern cities, you will pay something like 50 to 70,000 euro. Of course, that's still lower than the personnel cost than we have in Germany. But for example, it's more expensive than Eastern Europe or India, where the cost might be only 20, 30,000 euro. So in other words, you really want to balance and put the bulk of engineering there where it's most cost efficient, provided you have a very, very structured way of working. That means you need to spend some extra effort in requirements management and transferring requirements between the engineering teams in order to take advantage of this cost advantages.
Now, you are obviously in a leadership position, and I understand leadership to a great extent as team empowerment and giving ownership to the team members. Can you personally delegate all your work to your team members? And What's your role as the leader in such projects and in such an organization as you are in right now?
Yeah, I think that changed also for me personally, the leadership journey, so to speak. For sure, coming from a European background, we maybe have a tendency to want to democratize certain items and discuss them and align them in the team. At the end, organizations in China still tend to be more hierarchical, and the person at the top somehow clearly gives the direction and the tone. So this is something that I think in China a leader needs to be prepared to do, to give a certain direction to the team. And at the same time, and I think this is the tricky part, keep it so open that they don't shut out or shut up the voices from the company who try to talk. So I always try to do a balance. At the end, I need to make the decision. That's my job. But on the other hand, to keep the doors open so that the people feel comfortable to share with me their concerns. Because very often, their views and their experiences with their background of the market are very valuable and right on. And then I have to also change my mind sometimes and say, oh yeah, that's actually a very good point. So kind of a dualistic approach to leadership. Generally speaking, the role of the boss, I would say, is still more dominant in China than in Europe and maybe America.
So when you look at your teams and the people you work with, you have mentioned before the term technical experts, and you use them for training, for example. So how do expats or flexpats or these experts differentiate from your Chinese employees, your Chinese colleagues? In other words, why do you still need expats or flexpats?
First of all, they're not better. Yeah, they are just maybe have come with a slightly different flavor for one or two topics. So I think the experience, the level of professionalism of Chinese colleagues has always amazes me, especially their dedication to work and their summer work ethic and customer orientation. Yeah, this is really so much fun to work with. That said, I still think there is and will be some opportunities for international experts to work in China. One area is, as you mentioned, kind of technical experts or expats, so to say. Really people who bring over a core know-how, which doesn't exist yet here. They come over for a limited period of time, maybe 2-3 years, however long it takes, with the target of transferring that know-how. Or in some very, very special cases, as I mentioned before, maybe it's the secret sauce and they're the keeper of that. And then they just, you know, stay here for the time being and then maybe get rotated after a while. And this used to be more, and as more and more technology is developed locally, this becoming less, I would say. But there is still this category. The other one is maybe the on a higher leadership level, you have people maybe like myself, who actually are not delegated, but also locally hired. But still, the expectation from a company in Europe or in Germany, in this case, is we want to have somebody from a same cultural language background who can be the bridgehead, who can ensure that our interests in the country are met. I think this is, to some degree, will remain. It will become less as there's also more and more Chinese experts who have worked in international companies and who can do the job as well. But the way, who are then also not necessarily cheaper, because these people are also extremely well paid in the meantime. Finally, you have these flexpats, as we call them here, people who have been on a more junior level in China for a while, maybe even started their career here. And personally, I like to employ them. I think they are very, very helpful when it comes to really intercultural settings. So when it comes to interacting between maybe China and the headquarters or also other regions, when it comes to certain tasks that require a lot of reporting, that require maybe some very structural or analytic skills, which in my experience tend to be better understood and transported the message to the headquarters by these kind of flexpats. And they are maybe a little bit junior, and also from a pay level, not quite on the level as the technical experts that are brought over from Germany, but they're here long term. They really are building their career in China over the years, and make a very valuable addition to the company.
I'm specifically interested in the term technical experts for training, because also from other guests and also in my own job, I've experienced that this is getting more and more popular, because you don't want an expat for in China for a decade. It's extremely expensive. But also sending a technical expert for only 2 or 3 years can be very expensive if you consider the large German salary package, the accommodation costs, and any other kind of allowances for schools, etc. Do you think it's still worth paying that money when you can just, I mean, okay, that's maybe a bit extreme, but when you can just do all the training online? As we know, there was an avalanche of Zoom calls and all these online trainings. So how do you see this?
I think that's not black or white. I believe you can do a lot online. I think it has done in the last year and a half. A lot of that has moved to online, but I also see clearly the limitations. Yes, Zoom and WebEx and video calls are great, but it's still not quite the same as sitting down with somebody together, working on a project, working on a piece of code or on a hardware design. It's not that it's just a little bit more difficult. It's really different. So it's a band-aid, but it doesn't really replace the real thing. That said, you can probably reduce with this the number of business travel for sure. You can also reduce the number of technical experts that you bring over. But I don't think that this will be permanently replacing it. So I also think that as hopefully we are coming through the end of this pandemic, we will see an increase of people coming over and also an increase of business travel. It won't go back to the levels that we had before. I think that ship has sailed, but it will come back somewhat.
Now that we clarified the technical expert situation, you also mentioned that you really like hiring flexpats, especially for interculturally sensitive positions, let's say. So people who are already based in China, how will they, or how can they qualify and apply for a job in your company, for example?
So personally, I always look when I try to hire these kind of people to more hire by attitude. Yeah, they by definition do not have the deep technical experience of having worked in a specific field for 20 years in the headquarters, but they bring a lot of other qualities. Usually, a positive attitude, can do, being open, being customer and service oriented. Culturally sensitive, because they have worked and engaged in different cultures and being this kind of bridge function. Very important, of course, also that they are building up or have built up a strong network. So basically approached or are open to approach different teams, different customers, engage maybe in business development activities or consulting activities. And in my experience, I found in that area really excellent people and never regretted having brought them on board.
The ones that you've brought on board, how did you hire them? Maybe you can remember a few of them. Did they officially apply through the website, very old school or traditional, let's say? Or did you meet some of them on a networking event? Because that's what we always hear. Go networking, go talk to the right people and they might offer you a job. Did that actually happen to you? Did you hire people this way?
I would say all of the above. I have hired people through indeed even recruiters. Yeah, I have hired people through my personal network. I've hired people that I met at events of. There's so many forums and chamber events and events from consulting companies. So I would say all of them offer opportunity. Last but not least, I try to take a sip of my own medicine and engage a lot in LinkedIn and WeChat. And I've also received a lot of requests through that. So I would say be open and keep all channels open.
Assume you have these flexpats willing to work in China. What are your thoughts about their lifestyle costs? Because many professionals in leadership positions want to also start a family, right? And this is, can be really expensive, but I think this is relative, because if you have lived in Germany for a long time, you are used to a certain standard of living, standard of housing, food, restaurants, etc. Can people on a local contract, can foreigners on a local contract maintain that living standard?
Yes and no. I think there are some things in China which are, especially now speaking about Shanghai, and that's different in other cities, but since Shanghai has the largest expat community, let's talk about that. Shanghai is simply the most expensive city in the world, and especially so for foreigners who maybe don't do all their shopping in Lianhua or the local supermarket, but from time to time go to Carrefour or even to the city shop. So it's expensive, and you somehow need to find a way to pay your life. There's two aspects which are particularly expensive. One is housing. I mean, that's also expensive for Chinese, but a lot of Chinese come from families who maybe have already afforded 15, 20 years ago when it was affordable to buy an apartment. So they have an advantage, so to speak, for that. Whereas people who come here over to work, they need to rent probably, unless you happen to have some million euros lying around to buy an apartment, which most of these people will not. And the other thing that is expensive is school. So if you want to bring your child to an international school, and you kind of have to, because as a foreigner, you're not allowed to go to a local Chinese school, and it would be extremely difficult for the child anyway. And the cost for a school is, depending on the type of school you go to, somewhere between 180,000 roundabout RMB up to 300,000 per year. So roughly 30,000 to 50,000 euro, or 30,000 to 40,000 euro, and not quite 25,000 to 30,000 euro per year. And I mean, that is something that is simply not in everybody's pocket with a starting salary. So that is something to consider when you want to start a family, and to certainly discuss with your spouse and also with your employee how you're gonna handle that. It's now being made more difficult by the decision of the Chinese government to reduce the tax-free aspects of that. So in the past, that part of the gross salary that goes to schooling and housing basically was not taxed. This will now change. So this will make it even more expensive for companies to hire expats in China. So we'll see how that goes. Very important is also to align, I think, with your spouse. I think not a small percentage of these flexpats will be maybe in an international marriage. And then it's even more important to have a clear view of what you want in the coming year. So you need to do a little bit more life planning and look a little bit more ahead, I would say, than you do that in Germany. But it's not impossible. And I would advise somehow have a plan B, have a plan how you might go back to Germany. And especially before you decide to have a child and raise a child, consider the effects of this, and also depending on the type of relationship you have, how you want to raise your child. Certainly for Chinese children, for Chinese, but also for international kids growing up in China, it's a quite different world than their counterparts in Europe or in Germany with regards to requirements at school and others. So I would say, have a good plan, do your homework beforehand, but then it's absolutely doable. And I know lots of people who are happily married and raised children on a flexpat salary in China.
Coming to the end of this conversation, Peter, what would be your last bit of advice for the next generation of flexpats and expats or technical experts, whoever wants to come to China?
I think having in your resume, a stay in China is always a plus point. So be bold, be daring. If you come over, especially when you're young and you want to try it out, or also an option when you have already gathered a lot of experience, maybe towards the end of your career and you still want to explore something new, and you're maybe past already the rat race behind you and you can take things a little bit more relaxed. It's really a country with a lot of things to learn, with a lot of cultural things to learn, a lot of dynamic, but it's not for everyone. So you might also come to the conclusion, and I know lots of people like that, who after a year, or a year is a bit short, but let's say after 2 years, come to the conclusion, very interesting, but not really for me. And then that's also fair. But in my opinion, it's always worth a try. And it's one of the most interesting and rewarding countries to work in at the moment.
Peter, thank you so much for taking the time today. And I'm really looking forward to the feedback for this episode. And I'm pretty sure people will have many questions. Thank you, Peter.
Looking forward. Thanks for inviting me, Patrick. Best regards. Thank you for listening. And any questions, please feel free to contact me directly.
Thank you for being part of China Flexpat community. Visit our website at chinaflexpat.com and follow us on LinkedIn. Goodbye and 再见.